Hello, welcome to 'Cause I'm Humanity. It's been a while, but today I'd like to talk about home, what we think of as home, and education, what we think of education, how it serves us, how it doesn't, and how we can liberate ourselves from unuseful thought patterns and structures that we inevitably ingest, living in an imperfect reality. So I'd like to talk a little bit about home first. I have a very interesting concept of home. I think like many people, we all have several identities and several identities that compile with one another so we can feel home. Now, of course, there are some people who do feel completely rooted to one identity. There are plenty of people. But for those who have a more multi-layered, more nomadic approach, then it's inevitability that wherever they live, certain parts of their identities won't be basked in sunshine and light as much as others would be. So I'm talking from the perspective of a person who calls Merseyside his home. This is where I grew up. I grew up in the Northwest. I grew up around Northwest accents, Northwest culture, Northwest people. And I think being back here for the past 5-6 weeks has meant that a lot of those old things have been coming back to me, washing over me, and I really had to just take time to be quiet and to allow those feelings. Some of them are positive, but I think a big chunk of them have been negative and have held me down, and in many ways they've kind of been like a weight of gravity on me. But I think it's all a necessary thing in order to reach those points where you can look down at yourself, look down at your understanding, at your own life. And those, I suppose, those local emotions, I can call them, you know, the anger, the resentment, or kind of the envy or the anxiety, all those different things, those local emotions, we have certain days where we can just feel truly enlightened, where we've climbed the mountain of ourselves, our own thoughts, and looking down, we can say, ah, that's why that's that like that. And really, we can make realizations that we can put into a few words. And I think when we're able to distill things into a few words, that's when we've reached a new life stage. So for me, coming back home has been entering this city, Liverpool, with new eyes. I'm now looking at Liverpool, holding contacts, not just in my pocket, but holding them in my palms every single day. And through those contacts, I'm able to lift many, many veils that were placed over me through my upbringing, through conditioning, through socialization. So now I can see that certain friendships that I held very dear to me in this new state of, I suppose, self-realization, of self-respect, I think I can see that certain relationships served me in a great way when I was younger, and younger can mean a year ago. But now that I'm demanding certain things, not of myself, but of the world, of how people treat me, how I treat other people, what I expect, what my standards are, I think naturally those friendships will come away. And they don't always have to be violent. They don't always have to end in shouting matches. But they can end in, you know, certain words passed and passed between each other. It might be in person, it might be over WhatsApp or wherever it is. But really, it's understanding that as you're beginning to see the full person that you are, all of your assets, all of your identities that I was just speaking about, you need to really step into a room with all of them on your shoulders rather than have them tucked into your, you know, into your backpack. Actually, you just carry every single one of those character attributes. And I think once you begin to lay them down on the table, when speaking to friends, when interacting with friends unapologetically, that's when you begin to see who you can carry with you to the next stage. And I think often friends who do want to come with you and do have the ability to come with you to the next stage, they will come, you know, without any of your intervention. They will come to you and they will see these changing aspects of you and say, I am here with you, I'm on board with this. And although I don't understand the full aspects of what you're talking about, I'm here for it and I'm here for you and I want to be with you as you grow. So really, those people who are so prominent in your life, the people who are took a more background stage, who, you know, you admired from afar, you spoke to here and there, they actually become the more prominent figures and they become the backbone of your new friendship group. So with that in mind, I think looking at anxieties, for example. Now, anxiety, I was watching Mind Explained series. It's on Netflix. And I think there's this episode on anxiety. And it really explains things in a very scientific way. It takes us back to our animal selves. And when we are in the wild, and of course we are in the wild every single day, but, you know, we pay bills and we have passports and we wear clothes and wear perfume, but really we are in the wild every single day. Certain things happen and, you know, we've all heard of fight or flight, but really what the documentary explained was the chemical that is released when, for example, a deer sees a lion in the savannah. That chemical that is released, that gets the heart rate going, that, you know, makes them alert, that gives them that boost of adrenaline to make them go, boom! What the animals have is the ability to express that anxiety every single day. And they are not under scrutiny from any of the other members of the animal kingdom. There are nobody's scrutiny as to whether that expression of anxiety is normal or not. They just do it. And every single being around them will conform to, you know, those actions that they've taken. So if an antelope runs across the savannah, then the other animals will watch, or the lion will chase it, or the other antelopes will run with it because they're feeling anxiety. And I think that is part of us in every single, you know, in every single day. Say if there's a terrible incident that happened in a city, people will see one person running and then other people run with it because they have a perceived lion that is a threat to their survival. And in that sense, that kind of prey mentality of defend yourself and run, I think that kicks in. I think what happens in modern societies is we are, rather than being seen as animals, we are being seen as more and more as machinery, as machinery who must conform to the certain matrices or systems that are determined by capitalism, which does mean that mental health, as societies grow and grow and grow, mental health issues will grow with them. So I'm thinking of I think people will have seen this, either heard it or read it or seen it on social media, where they talk about African people who have experienced traumas, either that's from war, several things, traumas where, you know, in inverted commas, Western psychologists, they see mental health as something that you must treat in a quiet room, that must, you know, you must have certain, you know, appointments, and everything needs to be gauged in that way. Whereas the challenge for that was actually for African people, they were able to dance and be in the sunshine and smile, and that was their way of dealing with those things. Now, I think in certain ways that has definite truths, absolute truths, in the sense that sunshine and community can be a absolute remedy to those problems. I would say, on the other hand as well, it's one-sided. Because really, just as in the wild, if we think of a house cat, for example, a house cat or a dog that has been abused in the past will carry that abuse with them to the present. And we can take that house cat out into the sunshine and have it run around and play and do all those kinds of things. But really, it's going to come back into that space and it's going to carry that trauma with it. So yeah, you can have a day at the fairground and lick your ice cream and get a tan, but in reality, the day-to-day lived experience is still going to be affected by those traumas. So I think really those such generalizations like that, you know, it's helpful to have them, yes, as a contrast to certain Western practices that you don't agree with, but also to take them with a pinch of salt, to add them into the nuance blender. So those are just some thoughts and that I've been having quite right now and that I'm having today. And I think in terms of home as well, when you come back home, people will see, especially with social media now, people will see the inner workings of your mind progressing. Now, that could be going into, you know, a more happy state than you ever were, or it can go into in a more angry state than you were before. And I think what I found with social media is this year, I've taken a more direct approach on addressing these issues that affect me as a person of who's part of several marginalized communities. So that would be people of color, black people, gay people, neurodivergent people, working class people. I don't know. I suppose as well, one that isn't addressed is people who are, how do I say this, who are accidentally individual. So we'll all know that one of the kids that we know from school who was always an individual, who was always doing their own thing. And I think when you're not empowered, when you're in a disempowered state, it means that you're open to bullying and open to criticism, and people see you as an easy target. And I think the reason why people see you as an easy target when you are an accidental individual, someone who doesn't fit well into herd mentalities, crowd mentalities, that kind of thing, it means that people will sense when they see someone who is able to adapt to certain structures in order that serve them. So people can see that if a person is able to be the cool kid. And I think the cool kid plays out throughout, you know, the whole spectrum of human experience. You know, the cool kid can be the cool kid in school, or they can be the person who is able to get the top of a political party, or the person who is able to thrive in an industry such as the fashion industry or the acting industries. They're able to play the roles of, you know, the sycophant, or the they're able to pretend that they are interested in a person's well-being, when really it's more of a self-serving nature. But because they're able to adapt to the negative demands of an imperfect system, they're able to thrive in it. So that would be, for me, what we'd deem as cool kids in different arenas of life. But actually, if you're a person who doesn't intuitively understand those structures and how to adapt to them, then that can leave you vulnerable. Now, I'd like to say that an empowered accidental individual can be the people who we really, really admire in life, the true icons that kind of sit within history. I don't need to give a list because we all have our own icons. But those true icons, those people who aren't just famous for fitting a certain society's paradigm of what is, I suppose, revered at a certain given time, but the people who are able to stand above that. And yes, they will conform to it in certain ways. They will be attractive, they will be intelligent, they will be talented in certain ways, but actually they are able to stand tall in that society, but holding on to their individual selves, which means not compromising to different waves and different sways that, you know, people will demand of them. So I think that is also what would be called a protected characteristic, as the law sees it, in a different reality. You know, we'd see people who are accidental individuals as people who can be discriminated against and, you know, need certain reasonable adjustments in order for their lives to progress as they should. But that's not the world we live in. It's not the society that we live in. And I suppose accidental individuals will only know if another person's an accidental individual through meeting them and speaking to them. And other people who aren't wouldn't quite be in the loop. So, looking at those things, I think coming back home can draw up so many different things. And I personally think that for me, using my use of social media has meant that a lot of the things that, because I was raised in a certain society that, again, is imperfect, a lot of the things that I wanted to say, I felt that I wasn't able to say them. I saw that they weren't able, that they wouldn't fit the paradigm of what we view as a success. So, especially today, what we see as success is sharing the most impressive, prolific, you know, shiny parts of ourselves in order to fit into, I suppose, capitalism's idea of what we should be. With social media as well, with social media being used as a tool of capitalism, we see, I think this is, you know, fear of missing out, or, you know, Instagram envy, all these different things. We see people pushing out their estimations of what capitalism believes that they should put out, And that is constant success, constant smiling, constant all these different things. And that is for the, you know, for the praise of their followers. You can have millions of followers who engage in this constant display of success. Now, I think I was definitely playing into that, and, you know, 20s are all about experimentation, about taking new paths and that kind of thing. And I'd say that with my use of social media, it was definitely a way of showing how well I could thrive under the, I suppose, the constraints of living in the so-called West, what I call Greater Europe. We will see several instances, famous people of colour who are all conforming to what a Western capitalist idea is of perfection. Now, this has been talked about a lot. But regarding, you know, myself as an individual, I think understanding that my experiences of prejudice, of discrimination, of the excesses of white supremacy, of homophobia to a certain degree as well, homophobia experienced not just in white communities, but in black communities, which is something I experienced in London, experiencing homophobia from Asian communities as well, and all of these different factors that were feeding into my experience and very, at times, very painful, very negative experience. I think these experiences didn't fit into the narrow view of what is expected of a physically attractive queer person of colour. It didn't fit into those paradigms. So those people are constantly made up, they're constantly wearing, you know, fabulous clothes. And I think really the reason why that is because those people who are members of those marginalized groups and ultimately imitate those old paradigms of what success is. So we think of Joan Crawford, and Joan Crawford would say, you know, I would never leave the house unless I look like Joan Crawford. So I think those paradigms of success haven't really changed. And of course, those paradigms of the Hollywood star system from the 30s, 40s, 50s, and obviously before that and beyond, they are informed by, you know, concepts of aristocracy. You know, we would only ever see Marie Antoinette or, you know, Elizabeth the First or whoever, Henry, whoever, any of these people. If we go to China, if we go to Africa, if we go to all around the world, we would never see those people not in their state of perfection. It would be seen as unroyal to see that person not in their finest clothes. And if we look at today's representation of people, that is very much the same, I think. And that is being pushed to extremes. And I think we just see these tips in mainstream culture. You know, I suppose grunge culture was all about showing yourself as being as messy as possible, as natural or whatever as possible. It was before that, the 80s and the early 90s was all about showing yourself as fierce, as done, as, you know, showing yourself, you know, smashing it in this capitalist world. You know, you put on those Chanel earrings, you do this, you do that, you get your car, you fly in first class, you know, Dynasty, darling, you know, all of that. You know, Diane Carroll, as Dominique Devereaux, who has just left us very recently. You know, I look at characters like that, or Hilary Banks, you know, look at black women thriving under a capitalist, you know, under the rule of a capitalist society. Obviously, I'd see them wearing, you know, the icons, the visual iconography, we can say, of capitalism, which is fur coats and perfect suits and fabulous earrings, gold jewellery, all of those things, makeup, lipstick, red nails, all of those, all of the iconography of what we deem as glamour in Western society. I thought, well, if I can imitate that, those women have the same skin color as me, and if I can shift and morph myself into that, then that's how I can show success. So, of course, that was what I was doing. I was succeeding very well at that. And being in a relationship, which meant I was economically stable, I was able to maintain that. I was able to have places to place my clothes, to access my makeup and shoes and all those different things, in readily accessible ways, meant that I was able to morph myself into those fantasy versions of the winners of capitalism. Now, realizations I've since made is how limiting the need to always be on for Black women, to always be on, and for queer people to always be on. I think queer people in the public eye, if you look at people who have been in Pose or other queer people of colour, you will see that when they're on the red carpet, they are always on, and those are the images that we see of them. And I think, I don't know them personally, but I think they definitely feel the pressures of being in that Eurocentric society of always being on, you know, what we call respectability politics, which is always, if we want to represent oneself being respectable, always on, then that means that we will demand the respect of the people who we would otherwise see as our oppressors. So I think these realizations that I have made, especially this year, and putting them into practice, has meant that, you know, accessing anger has seen my presence online changing very much, and, you know, leaving that relationship and being in a more economic precarious position has meant that I have put less attention into the outfits that I was creating. So, you know, outfits that would be comparing myself to these icons of Western culture, to supermodels, to film characters, to fictional characters, by showing myself that I can thrive as though I am a fictional character in my own curated reality. It meant that I was able to escape the breaking realities of being a marginalized person, which also meant that I was in the mentality where I'd see other people who weren't doing what I was doing, who weren't, you know, curating themselves as works of art, as fictional beings, but actually using social media as a way of showing how angry and disenchanted they are with the world. I would see them as people who were, you know, they weren't go-getters. They were complaining, you know, to use that term, they thought that they were, well, others of them living and that kind of thing. And of course, there very well may be people who are like that, who will actually have all those negative attributes that I spoke about. But on the other hand, there will be people who would have a lot to offer me as a person of colour, as a queer person, as all the other identities that I have, I carry. They have the capacity to teach me a lot of things, but because I had judged the whole group of people as unworthy of my time and, you know, complaining all these different things, don't be so down into dumps, just put on lipstick and strut out. You know, I was actually locking myself away, which I think really, if we talk about white supremacist capitalist structures, and really white supremacy is a henchman of capitalism, white supremacy, colorism, all these different things, you know, homophobia, all these different things are used in order to maintain the supremacy of the men who decided that this patriarchal, white supremacist kind of system could maintain its power. Of course, if we look at who is on the throne, those are the people who are people who make these rules. So if we look at, you know, number 10, if we were to go to Downing Street, if we were to look at the people who are on the walls, we would see very handsome, very well-dressed, fashionable people who are in their perfect Instagram shots. They would see those people as the people who are the deciders of power and the benchmark of who is deemed respectable and who isn't. So I think that is an important thing when looking at working class communities as well, because a white man in reality is the man that you'd see in a portrait, in an oil painting from the 1820s, and not the white man that you'd see on the street. So with all those realizations that I've been making and I'm explaining now, it's been quite alarming to people who've been witnessing it. And I've been seeing not just white people, but people of color who have been, in a way, they've been attacking and they've been questioning and they've been trying to derail me from this path that I'm now on. And in some ways, some people can be showing genuine concern, but then people can be, again, as I said before, the cool kids, people can be using those tools as a way of psychologically manipulating me, gaslighting me into derailing myself and going back to the person I was before, a person who was a people pleaser, who would do several things in order to gain, in an unequal, unfair society, to gain a certain amount of prestige and respect from people. So if I'm kind to them and I morph myself into what they want me to be, then that means that I'll be accepted by a wider range of people. However, what I'm finding now is that I'm no longer willing to do that, which means I'm going to be losing friends. So one important thing is understanding that things aren't black and white, and that means that not all white people are going to be your enemies and not all black people are going to be your friends. Because really, we are all educated and we're all socialized in the same white supremacist capitalist water society, which means that some of us will have an immunity to that sickness of the colonized mind, and some of us won't be, which means that if you directly oppose structures, matrices that people depend on for their livelihoods, whether they're white or they're black or, you know, people of color, some people will take an affront to that and go to attack you, because what you are inviting is cognitive dissonance. And I just finished watching this video series on a game that came out last year called Detroit Become Human. I found it very interesting. I am a big game. I don't own a game console now, so my geeky pleasure is to watch YouTubers who are gamers just give commentaries on them, and they give reviews and they go through the whole playthroughs. And I think that's a lovely way of engaging a game, even if you don't have a game console. And yeah, they deserve all those millions of followers. I think they do great work. But I was playing that game, and Jesse Williams, who is an actor, an activist, US activist, he is, I suppose, what people would call racially ambiguous. So he has what we'd see as white characteristics, he has blue eyes, and, you know, he has European-looking facial features, but then you'd say his nose is more African, and he definitely identifies as black. Though I think he is mixed with European, African, and indigenous blood. You know, he has that ancestry. But he plays an android, and the androids are what, I suppose, fill-ins for what black people served in the creation of the United States, you know, as the dispensable tools of capitalism, and also what the lower caste people in India would be, what the ethnic minorities would have been in Russia, in China, in, of course, in South America, the indigenous and the Africans as well, how all of these different people would be used to give the ruling class, you know, their right to rule over an underclass. An interesting one as well is Japan, which isn't that known. The Japanese came from the from what's known as China, and they went over to Japan, and they went over really as invaders, as colonizers. So they went over to a land where the people known as the Ainu were living, and those people, I think they have a lot, you know, facial, you know, speaking about faces, they resemble much more people who, I suppose, Aboriginal people. But anyway, you can Google image these people. I think their history is very, very interesting. I'd love to learn more about it. But yeah, the game is focusing on the androids who've been created, and the androids come in all different ethnicities, races, whichever term you use more. And it's interesting. So I think I know about Jesse Williams is because a person who is an ex-friend now, you know, I had to let go of them with this, you know, the stronger, more complex awareness of white supremacy and people who are with you and people who aren't. Sorry, rest in peace, that friendship. And I remember that they posted on WhatsApp this video that he had done. So he spoke about this invention of whiteness and how black people today are convinced that if they brand themselves, and if we, you know, we talk about entertainers, we talk about, say, rappers who would brand themselves with Gucci, with Chanel, with all these different brands. I think in a misguided way, they see that as a way of liberating themselves and empowering themselves. But ultimately, let's ask Signore Gucci and Madame Chanel what they thought of black people. And I don't think they would have cared very much about them. Maybe they didn't hate them. Maybe they didn't have an opinion. But I don't think they were fighting for their liberation, as other white people would have, not just in the 20th century, but also in the 19th century. So that's an important thing to understand. I think it's definitely a conversation that we need to have, to see more African designers, please. If we're going to have capitalism, then let's see African designers creating luxury African designs. I'd love to see that, because at the moment we see African couture, and it's something that we see in Ridley Road Market, and it's something that we giggle at, because in a way, by using the word couture, they're imitating Europe. But that is how white supremacy works and Eurocentrism works. But that's another talk. But yeah, in this game, it's been very interesting. And ultimately, Jesse Williams' character, as I said in that WhatsApp group, he is a very outspoken activist. And I think for me, it was quite seismic watching that, because he's obviously a person who's mixed with European ancestry, but he has decided to align himself with blackness. And for me, I was in that transitional stage, and I found it quite triggering, because I thought, oh God, he's saying bad things about white people. That can't be good. That was a little thought in my head, but really, it's all about breaking through that programming. And now I understand that the friend who had posted that on her WhatsApp group, I felt it was disingenuous, but I wasn't able to articulate why. But now I understand. I think it's what something that we call virtue signaling. So it's when people who are part of a majority group will post something because they think it's what will gain them social status. So again, it's that cool kids theory. They will be able to wear what kind and authentic people fight hard to get into mainstream consciousness. They will be able to wear them as bargaining chips, as prestige tools, as, you know, ways to gain, to garner respect and confirmation in this success and capitalist driven society. They will use them as tools as cultural capital, when ultimately they don't care. They're self-serving. And there's some people who, I think it's very difficult to leave those thought tracks. They can read as much as they want, but ultimately some people will read a book like Why I'm Not Talking to White People About Race, Why I'm No Longer Talking to White People About Race. They'll be able to use those books and read it, but only take it in superficially. They will then use those learning tools as, yes, dangerously as weapons, as weapons to put other people down. So as again, a white person could read that, and an intellectual or educated white person would read that, and they'd use that as a way of tearing less educated or less privileged, economically privileged people down, whilst continuing to portray these self-serving characteristics, but never actually evaluating their own selfish tendencies. So this is something I've noticed as well. It's extremely complex and takes a huge amount of time to actually understand these structures. But when you do, you are able to distill them and to give them to people who you want to bring into this understanding. But you're able to distill it so they can pass that information on to others in a very easy and accessible way, which I think is, why we're here. How do we fight the darkness? We speak to people on a level, and we gain knowledge from people who can give it, and then for people who we can help, we're able to give that knowledge. That's where I am. But that's a tangent, and really talking about the game again. It's interesting because it takes you on a journey through his role as an activist, as a person trying to free his people. So the androids are people who, they are machines. At the beginning of the game, they are addressed as it, and their antagonist is Cyberlife, their creators. And as these androids are challenged by Life's complexities, they are given the choice to become rogue, to become deviants, as it's addressed in the game, so they can break through their programming, and rather than, you know, experiencing abuse and taking it, allowing themselves to be killed, experiencing or witnessing injustice happening in the world around them. It could be the people who own them, because these androids are marketable commodities, just as enslaved people were in the past and ultimately aren't today, talking about modern slavery. But they're able to be commodified in that way, but they can choose to fight against that and to have their own sense of agency and to do the right thing. And I think ultimately it's a very interesting commentary on being human. You know, we are programmed to be machines for capitalism. That is what we are. So, of course, a black person can be an entertainer and they can say what they want, but really, I think, for example, a rapper who raps about how much money he has, how many women he has, or would talk about how many white women he has, as though white women are commodities in order to, you know, that one can show off. Ultimately, if they're talking about killing black people who are living in poverty or living in a white supremacist structure, if they are using that as ways of selling records, ultimately they are a machine that has been used by a capitalist system. So I think that's why we're seeing today, especially post-neoliberal world where we are now, I think that's why we're seeing the proliferation of those kinds of artists who spread that kind of message. And of course, there are artists who challenge that. But if we look at the mainstream of what the mainstream is accepting, those are the main figures we think of. And we can say we're not going to take it seriously, it's just a joke, but ultimately the message that is given, where we take it on or we don't at all, or we say it's just music, don't take it so seriously, it is informed by our history. And if we don't know our history, and if we don't know how that history informs our way of being, then we are bound to become machines. Just like those androids, the androids are complete slaves to their programming, to the programming that this company called CyberLife gave them. So, of course, choosing to break out of that programming means that the other androids around you, I suppose we can call the androids who are living under this programming in the human world, our real world, as their programming will tell them, they will see you as a threat, and then they will try to neutralize that threat. They will try to convince that threat that that person who has become a deviant, someone who has diverted away from the given path, then that's a threat to your programming. So it's a very interesting game. And I noticed as well how it's a choice-given game. So depending on the choices that one makes, it depends on the outcome at the end of the game. So this android Jesse Williams character, as the game progresses, he becomes this messiah figure who will free these people. And you see lots of references, different films. So Blade Runner, there's a detective character who's very, very, very cool. And his job is to neutralize these deviants, or the replicants, as they're known in Blade Runner. Lots of references from iRobot as well, in terms of, you know, the liberation of these androids, these robots, iRobot. It's in the name. So for me, it was very, very interesting. And seeing as well, watching it through my eyes as a person who has engaged with activism, seeing the choices given, you know, for this character who chose revolution. If you choose the side of revolution, it means that you end up in this all-out war where you attack this concentration camp that's been created to exterminate the android population. You can storm it, and you can go on a rampage, and ultimately the forces that be decide, you know, the president of that, it's 2008 it's set, no, sorry, 2038 it's set, or 2038, they decide that actually all the androids must be exterminated, and that's how it ends. However, if you choose the peaceful side, which is demonstration, which is remaining pacifist, pacifistic, is that the word? Then at the end of the game, then you will see that people are ultimately accepted, and people do accept that androids are a new intelligent life form, new species, and they should be treated in that way. You know, you sway public opinion by refusing to engage with violence. So I think it's very interesting, actually. It taught me a lot about myself and about the anger that I was portraying, and just understanding as well. I mean, I just wrote on Instagram today, let me just quote myself very unabashedly. Anger is a necessary stage of experiencing growth in an imperfect reality. It is not the end destination, but the fire of anger has the ability to burn structures down that keep us caged so new ones can be erected. Might take a few rewinds, but rewind as much as you like. But understanding now at this point in my life, the anger that I've shown on social media, in person, which has been alarming for people. It's a way of ripping down those structures. And even in the game I was just telling you about, the character animations, it is all about, you know, you'll have the text written, you know, protect your master. But you'll see these android characters ripping down those words violently, which is obviously an act of anger. But I think ultimately, it's a spiritual metaphor for the fact that we need anger to rip down the structures that are put in front of us, whether we like it or not. We need to live somewhere. And every single society has a structure, has a social order. So we need to rip those down, burn it all down to the ground, almost, at least within ourselves. But then that gives us space to rebuild. Thinking of Paris. Thinking of Paris, what his man did. That just metaphor just came up. Burn down the squalid streets, create something that is known as the most beautiful city in the world. Now, this isn't above criticism. And I think many activists today, especially people involved in black activism or blacktivism, will say that this is a pacifism and Martin Luther King, I think the portrayal that he is completely peaceful, it's, again, it's a tool of white supremacy to keep people obedient, to stop an uprising, which would be a danger to wider society, especially white society. It's what is known as respectability politics, as mentioned before. And Martin Luther King towards the end was much more aligned to Malcolm X, which is something I've read. So that, of course, can be up for criticism as well, up for debate. And it would be interesting to see the developers of the game, their political views. So maybe the political view, the members, of the people who wrote the gameplay, how it writes out, maybe they are white, maybe they are part of the dominant culture. And they brought in Jesse Williams as a person of colour, as a black person. But they were putting across their political views and how things can be achieved in a better way. Maybe yes, maybe not. But the more I'm understanding in life, nothing is black and white. Nothing is easy. Everything has a nuance. Every single thing has a nuance. And the most challenging thing in life is life. Ta-da! So I think those are certain things that are at the top of my mind right now. And I think as well, standing at this interesting bypass where I'm aware of how I was using whiteness as a means of validating myself and avoiding the truth, avoiding becoming a deviant who would challenge and anger the people who admired me for being so positive and being so, you know, lovable. I think it's an interesting moment for me. How do I hold on to the fact that, yes, I am partly European? Like, yes, I do hold my roots in this country, in Liverpool. I do have a great a Welsh grandfather. I do know lots of, you know, several European languages and hold a lot of my history and understanding of myself in European thought. How do I move forward in embracing that, but not allowing it to overcome my blackness? You know, that is an interesting bypass. And I'm excited and very interested into what comes next. And yeah, what the future holds. What the future holds. I'm very, very, very interested. You know, I think I've seen things written down like this where you say, understanding but not complicit, passionate but not hateful, or self-loving but not self-serving, all those different things, you know, just keeping that balance in order to be a good and kind and compassionate human being. It's just a constant thing. It's a constant thing. And no wonder we've had so many philosophers talking about just this, the human condition, because the older I'm getting, the more complex I'm understanding it all is. So I think I'd like to leave it there. I hope you enjoy this latest installment of 'Cause I'm Humanity. And I think I've been singing a song at every single ending of my podcast, but I'm not going to do that today. I'm not. I'm going to wait till the next time. Bye!